Hey everybody, welcome to an extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about Frozen. I'm one of your hosts, the funky-looking donkey, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today as always.
Hey, I'll be a happy snowman. It's Henry Gilbert.
And yes, this month we're ending the year of 2024 and beginning the year of 2025 with a real crowd pleaser, Disney's Frozen, the 2013 movie that really rejuvenated them. It's the hit they were looking for ever since 1994's The Lion King, and they finally got it with this film. And we had a lot of fun talking about this wintry movie, perfect for this season.
It melted the frozen heart of the box office for Disney original content, and it did kind of shove Pixar to second place in the Disney animation sector.
Yes, and in this little preview, you're going to hear a chunk of the history of Frozen, how it was in the works around the time of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and it took that long to cross the finish line. But if you want to hear the entire thing and our entire discussion of the movie, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. And when you do, you'll unlock, I believe, an additional 60 What a Cartoon Movie podcast. Maybe, is it 70? I can't do math right now. It's so cold in here.
Oh, yeah. I guess with 6 years, this would be our 73rd, I think.
Wow. See, yeah, my math is failing me right now. But it's what a bargain, everybody. You're going to get so many movie podcasts if you sign up at that $10 level. We've covered the entire Disney Renaissance. We've covered all the Toy Story movies. We've covered so many things. Anime, weird little movies like the Beavis and Butthead films, the Rocko's Modern Life movie. Like Henry said, there are over 70 of these so far. They're all between 3 and 6 hours long, and you'll get 6+ years worth of them all at once if you sign up at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons at that $10 level. And there is a $5 level. When you sign up for the $10 level, you get all that stuff. What's going on at the $5 level, Henry?
Well, first of all, Bob, it gets you every episode of Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon ad-free and early. You don't have to hear any of the ads you hear on the free feed, but you also get tons of more bonuses. I'd say 200 of them at this point are very close to it. Every month you get a new episode of Talking Futurama and Talk King of the Hill. We're in the Comedy Central years of Futurama, and we're just starting up season 4 of King of the Hill, and we go just as in-depth to those as we do into Frozen, and we have covered so many over the years at that $5 exclusive level. We have covered every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and many of our favorite episodes of Batman and the Animated Series. There is a ton of awesome stuff there, and also a bunch of interviews, including an interview with the director of the short that preceded Frozen. There's so many cool things at that $5 level that you get access to at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons just for $5 a month. But the $10 level gets you all that, plus all of the movies we were talking about.
And if you've never signed up for Patreon before, it is very easy to do. Just go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, sign up there, and then afterwards you can use any podcast app or device you normally use to listen to all of our bonus podcasts alongside all of your regular podcasts as part of your podcasting lifestyle. Again, that is patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Now bundle up and get ready to hear a preview of the history of Disney's Frozen. We really haven't checked in on 21st century Disney history since we covered Chicken Little. And that movie was a big hit, by the way, because Chicken Little was a hit. Disney could buy Pixar. Remember that. It's a dark fact of history. So I briefly want to set the stage for where Disney is during this time period. So, of course, the decade kicks off with the underperforming Atlantis, The Lost Empire, and the absolute bomb, Treasure Planet. And sandwiched in there are hits like Lilo and Stitch. That's a surprise hit as the studio is backing away from traditionally animated features, though they are putting out more 2D movies in this era than any of us remember, including 3 Winnie the Pooh films. There are 3 2D Winnie the Pooh films out in the aughts, and I think they've just been wiped from everyone's memory because there's so much poo everywhere on Disney Plus.
Though every now and then I'll see it get shared, like clips from it shared from animation accounts that are just like, yeah, look at this incredible, like Bruce W. Smith animated rabbit for this scene. And it looks incredible. It's some of the best. It's sadly where a lot of the top 2D guys could get work for a few years was just on like, well, we're still making Winnie the Pooh in 2D. We haven't shifted away from 3D to 3D on that yet.
Yeah, animation, 2D animation did not end with Treasure Planet, of course. There was Lilo and Stitch before that. After that, there was Brother Bear, I think a bigger hit than Lilo and Stitch, and Home on the Range, which I guess made money, but nobody cares about it. I've always been interested about that because I think it was them trying to make like a Tex Avery-style more Warner Brothers-y, zanier animated movie.
It felt like it just came at the wrong time. And I do recall the Brother Bear. It was a point of discussion in that Disney Orlando Animation YouTube documentary I saw, and how the director of Brother Bear was like, oh, we proved we could do something great with Brother Bear, but it didn't matter enough, was the feeling.
One of these days I'll watch it. It looks interesting. Or at least it has a lot of Canadian content that I can really get behind right now.
It's good. I remember liking it. Though I can't watch it or hear the soundtrack of the credits without thinking I'm cleaning up popcorn, because I was doing that. It was in theaters when I was ushering at a movie theater.
So it's a lot of ups and downs for Disney, and Pixar is completely stealing the show when it comes to critical praise. This is the decade in which Pixar could do no wrong. They're winning Oscars. This is before Disney buys them and turns them into a sequel machine. Different time entirely. Go back to our Incredibles podcast, our Cars podcast. We talk about the contentious history between Disney and Pixar and their eventual absorption of Pixar. But the studio's 2D era comes to a close with 2009's The Princess and the Frog. And after the acquisition of Pixar, the studio starts to turn the corner with 2010's Tangled, which feels like the first animated feature that caused jaded 90s Disney fans like us to realize the studio could actually put out a worthwhile CGI feature. Keeping in mind, the last three were Chicken Little, Meet the Robinsons, and Bolt. And I know people out there seem to like Meet the Robinsons, but when I watched it, I just thought it was very, very mediocre.
And with Bolt, I remember like how I was a very big Ain't It Cool News reader back then, and how it had been first sold as like, you know, this was a Chris Sanders vehicle, like for a famous dog story. And then he got fired from it and it just turned into this thing instead, Bolt. And everybody was just super negative on it when it came out. But yeah, Tangled, I didn't pay enough attention to it when it first came out, because I thought it was just like Bolt and Meet the Robinsons and Chicken Little, even though it was a return to the fairy tale musical that is what I loved growing up from Disney as well.
With Alan Menken music as well.
Yes.
Stapled onto that. I need to watch that movie. I have played the Kingdom Hearts level. I know it's different.
Yeah, just know that in every one of your favorite Disney films, that just off to the side were Sora, Donald, and Goofy having some fun.
And then that movie, of course, has the guy with all the swords pointed at him because he said a bad opinion online.
Oh,
right?
God. Yep. Yeah,
Is that Tangled?
That is Tangled, yes. No, I was just thinking like, yep, that's all. The memes are what you know for. I'm too online too. Yeah, when watching this movie, I was just like, oh, there's that meme, there's this meme. It's just all these memes are how I view things now.
Well, we're in the era of the meme presidency, so it's time to start boning up on your memes. Mostly very, very old ones.
Yes. My husband just made fun of me last night for referencing a meme that was too old. That I put on the Rugrats Christmas episode. I was telling him, I'm like, oh, this is the first appearance of Angelica's mom in the show. And he's like, oh, do you know the new Angelica's mom's meme of her screaming like that gif? And I was like, yeah, oh yeah, I've seen that. Though my favorite one is, you know, Stu making the pudding and losing control of his life. And then my husband basically called me grandpa for referencing that as a meme.
What is this, 2017? What am I looking at here? Yeah, I don't know that. I didn't know that there was a new Angelica's mom meme. I'm sorry, folks. I'm not on TikTok. So, but TikTok will be illegal soon, so that's fine. I don't need to be on it. It's going to be outlawed.
Soon we'll be safe.
Yes. So after Tangled, the trend continues with 2012's Wreck-It Ralph, which, you know, obviously will be a What a Cartoon movie in the near future. And I believe that was the first animated Disney feature I saw in theaters since The Emperor's New Groove. I saw Emperor's New Groove. I sat out all of their movies for 12 years, and then I came back for Wreck-It Ralph, mostly because I was hosting a retro video game podcast, and I still am, by the way, but I ended up enjoying it. So a year after Wreck-It Ralph comes Frozen.
Yeah, yeah. I saw Wreck-It Ralph in theaters because it was free to see it. It was. I got invited to a press screening as well. And when I enjoyed Wreck-It Ralph, I did kind of say to myself, well, yeah, it's because they hired people who aren't Disney people. Like they hired Rich Moore and others. And they made a good film under the Disney machine. But Disney's washed. I was still thinking Disney couldn't make a good movie.
I saw Wreck-It Ralph at what is now the only remaining theater in Berkeley, California on College Avenue. If it still exists, please support them because they need your help.
God, it's so depressing. I just was back in Oakland and San Francisco as well last month, and I couldn't even bring myself to go to Oral Berkeley Stomping Grounds. It just would make me sadder and sadder of everything being closed.
Now I live around too many movie theaters. It's great, but they were just like dropping like flies in Berkeley. It was so sad. Anyways, that's our local history for you folks out there. Let's talk about Hans Christian Andersen. So for the creation of Frozen, Disney relied on a writer whose public domain works kicked off their 90s Renaissance era. And of course, I mentioned it before, it's Hans Christian Andersen. You might remember him from such tales as The Little Mermaid, where at the end she turns into foam. Disney went a different direction with that story, but it's much different in his version.
But very, very smart of them to get back to the Hans Christian Andersen that helped them so much in the past. Like it spiritually makes sense if you're wanting to get to return to the money and prestige of the Disney Renaissance.
And by the way, his name is Hans Christian Andersen, and it's a complete coincidence that four characters are named Hans, Christoph, Anna, and Sven. The creators of the movie had no idea that they were making that reference, but I guess just because they're pulling all of these Scandinavian sounds out of thin air, they will eventually form Hans Christian Andersen.
My mind is blown hearing that. I never thought of that as a reference. Wow.
And in case you're wondering, Disney adapted the following Andersen stories into animated things. So we have silly symphonies like The Ugly Duckling and The China Shop. And The China Shop was based on his story titled The Shepherdess and the Chimney Sweep. The Piano Concerto No. 2 segment of Fantasia 2000 is based on a story titled The Steadfast Tin Soldier. And the 2006 Disney short, The Little Match Girl, was based on one of his stories. I guess it was intended to be in Fantasia 2000 and didn't make the cut. And it's not an adaptation anyway, but The Emperor's New Groove, the title references The Emperor's New Clothes, which was a Hans Christian Andersen story.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Now, The Little Match Girl one, if I recall correctly, because I think we've talked about that director, I think it was Roger Allers, but I believe the intention of Fantasia 2000 was Roy E. Disney was going to do what Walt wanted to do with the original Fantasia, which was have it be a touring film and you update it every year or two. So there was a pipeline for shorts that would just be reintegrated with a re-release of Fantasia 2000. But Fantasia 2000 did so poorly that they just scrapped that and then quietly finished and released those ones. And also, I do believe the Little Match Girl, unlike the Little Mermaid, they kept the darkness of the ending in that story.
It was Oscar bait. All of these shorts were made to win Oscars. Thankfully, a lot of them are on Disney Plus, but not all of them. They would make a short every year that you would just hear about and not know how to watch. But now you can see a lot of those on Disney Plus.
And the Little Match Girl was smartly partnered with the Blu-ray of The Little Mermaid, which I had used for part of the prep for the Little Mermaid podcast we did.
And speaking of The Little Mermaid, I'm sure we covered Andersen during our history segment of that podcast. But to give a brief recap, he's a Danish writer, mostly famous for his 156 fairy tales published across 9 volumes. And if not for the attention that Disney brought to The Little Mermaid, The Snow Queen would likely be his most popular and acclaimed story, because I think The Ugly Duckling is mostly known as a metaphor that is way outdated now and not a story you sit down and read. Like, we know, like, oh, she's a real ugly duckling. She's going to grow up to be beautiful. No one thinks about, well, what is the actual text of The Ugly Duckling? What is it saying?
I mean, Lisa destroyed it for when Marge sang the song and it was never to be heard from again. She's like, so you're saying I'm ugly? No, you're one of the good-looking ducks who makes fun of the bad-looking one.
Yeah, it's not something you should trot out anymore. But he meant well. So originally published on December 21st, 1844, in New Fairy Tales, first volume, second collection, The Snow Queen is a departure from Andersen's other fairy tales in that it's a 7-chapter saga, meaning it's basically 20 pages if you download the PDF from Gutenberg.org, which I did. So I like to read the books for these now that I do this full time. Thankfully, I only had to read 20 pages of The Snow Queen.
Nice. That's a good more. That's a bit shorter than Tarzan.
Yes. Tarzan.
And less go
back
racist,
to that podcast.
Probably.
Yes. not racist at all. I don't know. Let me check my sources again. But at this point, I was going to go over how different the original story is. But basically, everything is different. And the story of Frozen drifts so far from the original Snow Queen story that I think they only credit Andersen so no one would call them out on it. No one would say, oh, you totally ripped that story off without giving him credit. So it's like, yes, technically there's a Snow Queen and then this other thing happens. But outside of that, just stealing the basic idea of a Snow Queen, they're not similar at all.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Because it's an antagonistic thing with the Snow Queen, right? Like she is a villain, right?
Yeah. And she's more of like a ethereal spiritual creation, not just a person cursed with powers. So I can go over the basics here because I did read it and write a little summary. So the story is about a boy and girl. The boy is named Kay. The girl's named Gerda. By the way, all the names are different too. So Kay gets kidnapped by the Snow Queen and Gerda goes on this episodic adventure to save him. And there's no final confrontation. Gerda eventually makes it to the Snow Queen's castle while she's out frosting the tops of mountains. And she takes Sven home, or not Sven, I'm sorry. She takes Kay home with her, Gerda does. So there is a Snow Queen and there are trolls, kind of, because the prologue to the story sets up the fact that trolls created this evil spyglass where everything you view through it looks much uglier than it is. So of course, when you have a spyglass like that, what do? You fly up to heaven and you use it to make fun of God. So while they're making fun of God, they drop the spyglass, it shatters on the earth, people get shards of it embedded in them, and the little boy Kay gets a little fleck of the glass in his eye and a shard through his heart. Those events lead him to get kidnapped by the Snow Queen. So when Gerda finds Kay, the hot tears of her crying melt the ice in his heart, and Kay's own crying melts the ice, melts the glass in his eye. So the idea of the ice being melted when the two people reunite, that's also from the story, but that's kind of it.
Okay. Well, it sounds like the opposite with the trolls, in that, like, instead of the trolls helping somebody and being like these caretakers, instead they're like jerks.
Yeah. By the way, I don't like the trolls in this movie. I think they're hideous, and you could tell that no one else did because they show up in Frozen for about 15 seconds of screen time.
Oh, yeah. No, the
Frozen
trolls
2,
are,
Frozen 2.
Yes. No, the trolls are so... Nobody likes the trolls. I didn't see... For all of the endless Frozen merchandise, and again, I have just been to Disney parks and saw... like at least five little girls all dressed in, you know, the little girls go to Disneyland dressed as princesses. Like some of them do, the really hardcore ones, multiples dressed up like Elsa, and nobody is hugging a troll doll. Like nobody cares about these fucking trolls. Like Olaf is the only magical creature in this movie as far as most kids are concerned.
And DreamWorks, they have the Trolls movies, so they don't want to popularize trolls any more than they already are.
Yeah, and they pulled it off. They made the right choice again of like, well, yeah, trolls should be like fun and colorful instead of just like indistinguishable from a mossy rock.
And I will say, given the standards of modern narratives, and by modern, I mean within the past 100 years, this story is kind of weird and not good. I hate to throw shade at Hans Christian Andersen. I'm not going to tear him down. He's already, you know, on a pedestal enough, but... When I was reading this, I just thought, was he famous because he was the only adult man to have an imagination? Because this fairy tale, at least, is a big like, and then this happened, and then that happened. It feels like a kid kind of making something up on the spot because it's all weird and fantastical and not tied to any actual kind of reality. It's not like reality with magical elements. It's like, oh, and then, you know, Gerda wants to know where Kay went. So she asks every flower where he went, and every flower has a different story. It just feels like a lot of ass pulling to me, but... It really captured people's imaginations in the, I think, 18th century is when he was writing these.
Wow. So the queen is like just not there when Gerda finds Kay. Like they're just set, like there's no dramatic like confrontation or anything.
No, the queen's like, I'm going to go frost some mountain tips. You hang out here, Kay. I've kidnapped you for some reason. And then Gerda shows up and the queen, there's never any kind of confrontation. She is not defeated. The queen is kind of like a Jack Frost figure in that. She is used to explain, well, this is why your windows are frosted at night, and this is who makes the snow appear on the mountains. It's more of like an indigenous tale almost, explaining like how these elements of nature came into being.
But I guess I can see that a classic fable of a girl saving a boy is different from so many other Disney films, and that does come into this a little bit of the female power of the Frozen.
Yeah, but I swear, like, outside of three things, the Snow Queen, the melting of, in this case, the shard of ice in the heart, it's glass in the original story, and there is a reindeer that brings Gerda to Kay in the Snow Queen's castle, that's kind of it. Yeah, and the trolls, too, but the trolls are absolutely different, and they don't actually function in the story. There's a prologue about their evil spyglass. That's it.
Wow. Man, well, that's, yeah, so I can see why... everybody would have given them crap for not crediting Hans Christian Andersen as a starting point, but you're right. It's so different as it almost feels needless to do that.
Yeah. So needless to say, the Snow Queen received a lot of adaptations, mostly in countries that aren't America, because it just doesn't, I don't think it really appeals to Americans. So I can talk about one adaptation. I don't want to go over all of them because there have been many, but I think our listeners might be interested in this one. There was a 2005 anime adaptation of The Snow Queen, directed by anime legend Osamu Dezaki and animated by TMS. And Dezaki, of course, is the legendary director who came up with the concept of postcard memories, and that is a classic anime technique in which a cell fades into a much more detailed drawing, usually to end an episode.
Wow, man, a TMS done one. That's incredible. I want to look this one up now, too.
It looks like some of it has been subtitled by fans, maybe like six episodes, but it looks interesting, I'll say. And I'm wondering how they turn this 20-page story into what I think is like a 36 or 42 episode anime series.
Man, impressive. That predates Frozen by several years. That's impressive.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people adapted this, and Frozen just chose to just, what if there was a Snow Queen and then we make everything else up? That's kind of what their own take was. So that's Hans Christian Andersen and the Snow Queen. Let's talk about the movie Frozen. So the history of Disney adapting the Snow Queen goes back to the late 1930s, where before the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, Walt Disney was dreaming up a feature film about Hans Christian Andersen. And in this proposed project, live action bumpers would be shot by the Samuel Goldwyn Productions Company, and they would serve as material to go between cartoons animated by Walt Disney. And one of them would have been the Snow Queen. So this goes back to pre-Snow White. But the Snow Queen was not going to be a feature. It would be a story told in a larger feature that would have live-action segments, so it wouldn't be all animation.
So more of just an anthology film and not a feature. But yeah, I had, in our years of research, I definitely think I've come across this project once or twice before, and that I do believe this came up in one case when I was doing the Little Mermaid research. Yeah, that Walt Disney had some contact with the Snow Queen and wanting to do something with it. So it's impressive that they're going back to Walt once again for something.
But World War II scuttled these plans, as well as major failures like Pinocchio and Fantasia. World War II saved Disney, of course, we talked about that, but this pushed the Christian Andersen story way down the line. But in 1952, Samuel Goldwyn just make this movie on their own as a live-action musical without any help from Disney. And I think Boomer saw this a lot on television because it was referenced a few times in the episode Principal Charming. The Inchworm song from this musical is used as Principal Skinner's leitmotif when you hear the little, like, dreamy, playful song when he's doing things with Patty, I believe. Is it Patty?
Yeah, it's Patty, yeah.
That's from the musical, and we talked about that in that episode. But the writers of Mystery Science Theater must have seen this a lot, and maybe it's because they're all Scandinavian or living in Minnesota, but the riff, Anderson, that's me, that's from the Hans Christian Andersen musical. They would do it a lot, and it always baffled me, like, who is Andersen? Why are they singing? But I guess that was one of the songs. He would say, Anderson, that's me.
That's fun. Yeah, Inchworm's the only one I knew from it, even, and it was that Andersen one probably just went back in the back of my head, like all of the other the many Mystery Science Theater jokes that never made sense to me as a kid and only unlock in adult or much later viewing or googling
helps. So Disney did not completely wash their hands of the Snow Queen, and thanks to Jim Hill Media for the scoop on this. Jim Hill Media did a lot of research into the many different attempts at making Frozen, or at least the Snow Queen adaptation. So a few decades later, in the early 70s, Disney legend Mark Davis proposed a dark ride adaptation of the story called The Enchanted Snow Palace. But this concept never came into being, and in case you're wondering what is there now, it's the Fantasyland Theater. So that sits where this Enchanted Snow Palace ride would have been.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Man, I always skip over that Fantasyland Theater because it is like the baby dance section. Like, well, I have no need to. I only spent time in Fantasyland proper this time because my mom had never ridden all these things before. So I was like, well, I've never ridden Casey Jr. before, but let's do it. Let's check off everything on this list.
Did you go on all these scary dark rides from the 50s, like Pinocchio and Snow White and all those ones?
Yes, yeah, we went on both of those. Though they have spruced up the Snow White one that it is less scary. And though, yeah, my mom was most, she, I think, most loved the Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. And she was just as surprised as anybody is on that, that you travel through hell and then it ends. It's like, no, you're dead and in hell. The end.
You sent your mom to hell.
Yeah.
But then you leave and you're in Disneyland, which is heaven. So Disney didn't wash their hands of the Snow Queen completely, like we said. The passing decade saw many Disney-employed folks take a crack at pitching their own adaptation, including a little guy named Javi Feierstein. So back when he was voicing Yao Mulan, he pitched this to Disney. They didn't take him up on it. So he was interested in doing this for some reason.
Wow.
And then before working on Tangled, animation legend Glenn Keane took a crack at this, but could not figure it out. What really stumped all these guys was the fact that the story has no resolution. There is no confrontation. There's nothing to be figured out. The girl just finds the boy and cries, and then the day is saved.
I mean, it makes sense for the way Hans Christian Andersen tells it, but because it's like, what are you going to do, defeat winter? Like, no, you're not going to. But that's why they have them kill Ursula at the end of The Little Mermaid instead of, like, the Little Mermaid realizes a man loves somebody else, and so she kills herself. The end.
Yeah. Very few Disney movies end in suicide, we found out. Not popular, doesn't test well. So yeah, Glenn Keane tried to make it work. He couldn't make it work. But thanks to the 9,000-page book Disney War, we have some fly-in-the-wall accounts of creative meetings about Frozen. So during a 2003 meeting, Michael Eisner seems a bit bored with the whole Rapunzel idea. So he turns to the topic of the Snow Queen, which he's actually very interested in. Huh. And to quote Disney War, quote, "I love the Taming of the Shrew idea," Eisner says. "Take Martha Stewart. She's tough, smart, a worthy adversary. If she were a doormat of a woman, no one would go after her. Marlo Thomas used to call me about marketing that girl. She said, if I were a man, I'd be president of the network." Eisner expresses some reservation about the team assigned to the Snow Queen, then adds, "John Lasseter, if we make a new deal with Pixar, dot, dot, dot." So he loves the Snow Queen, and he's thinking about giving John Lasseter the idea to make that idea at Pixar. And John Lasseter, a beloved animation figure at the time, he thought, we've never done a Disney princess thing before, and we really want to do it. So the Snow Queen could have been a Pixar movie in the late aughts.
Wow. Wow. Well, I mean, I definitely saw the John Lasseter's name in the credits for this movie. So, I mean, he seemed to still believe in the project. But it's so funny. Eisner compares it to, like, one, the Taming of the Shrew, and like he's like, it's about a feisty broad. But then he compares it to, you know, women who, like, of his generation who he knew, like Martha Stewart and Marlo Thomas.
When he brought up Marlo Thomas, I'm sure everyone in the room was like, oh God, here he goes again.
It's like from those Quibi postmortems where when it was Gal Gadot had a meeting with Jeffrey Katzenberg, and Jeffrey Katzenberg was like, oh, you should do a fitness thing like Jane Fonda did. Like, just these guys are stuck in the past with that stuff.
You know what? I was watching a documentary the other day, a new one, and I saw Chrissy Teigen on it as a talking head. I was like, where the hell did she go? When you brought up Quibi, I just remember Chrissy's Court. Of course,
right,
we're all thinking
right.
about Chrissy's Court. So many men were put to death because of Chrissy Teigen.
I had heard from one of our comedy pals that, like, oh yeah, when you meet with a Chrissy Teigen type, and by that I mean like a famous person who's looking for something to do, their first pitch is always a judge show. Like, hey, what if I was Judge Judy? Like, that's their instant first pitch.
Boy, that's very strange. So Eisner wants to give this idea to Pixar, and apparently the idea is loved by Lasseter. And after discussing possible adaptations of Jack and the Beanstalk and Hansel and Gretel and Rumpelstiltskin, Eisner ends the meeting by saying, I love the Snow Queen. Let's do the Snow Queen. So Eisner, way behind the Snow Queen idea. And at some point, plans for this adaptation eventually fell apart. But Disney wasn't yet finished with these pre-Frozen attempts to adapt the Snow Queen. In March of 2006, Disney announced they'd signed composer Alan Menken to a multi-picture deal. And with this announcement came the news that Menken would be adapting The Snow Queen into a stage musical set to debut at Tokyo DisneySea. And apparently Menken made a lot of progress when it came to developing the musical. You can hear one of the songs online, at least a demo of it. But this production was abruptly canceled, and there wasn't any official reason why. Jim Hill speculates that Disney wanted the feature to come first and a stage adaptation to follow, which sounds like a pretty reasonable analysis to me.
No, that totally makes sense. Man, that it would debut at Tokyo Disney is so interesting. Like, though, I definitely have gotten the sense that American musicals playing at Japanese theme parks are a big draw. I just learned this about Wicked, that Wicked, I believe it debuted in Japan first as a medley of the songs were performed at Universal in Osaka.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, the Japanese audience loves American musicals. When I went there last year, I saw ads for the Sister Act musical that was being performed there. And then this year, I saw that the Back to the Future cast would be there in April doing the show.
Nice.
So, yeah, and they love Back to the Future in Japan.
As they should. Just like their love of the Carpenters, they're right in loving Back to the Future.
They're right to do it. So yes, work on a new animated version of The Snow Queen began. So we have Pocahontas co-director Mike Gabriel teaming up with Tangled songwriters Alan Menken and Glenn Slater to try to figure things out. But like many of the people working on this idea, they can't figure out the story issues, so this version gets scrapped as well. So we have all of these attempts to make The Snow Queen. And now we jump from the mid-aughts to 2011, when Walt Disney Animation Studios is trying yet again to make The Snow Queen into an animated feature. And at this point, Tarzan co-director and soon-to-be Frozen co-director Chris Buck, who we'll talk about soon, he's the only director assigned to this project, and he's having the same problem so many others had with The Snow Queen. Elsa, as she would later be known, is very unrelatable, hard to understand. In the story, she's a force of nature, and her motives are unknown, and that makes for a bad antagonist in your story.
Yeah, no, like you said, like even in the original one, she just vanishes so somebody can just save the other character without any conflict.
And it's really hard to pin down a timeline of what happened after the green lighting of Anna and the Snow Queen, later renamed Frozen. By the way, it's still called that in some territories.
Oh.
We watched part of the Japanese version on our hotel room TV, and it is Anna and the Snow Queen in Japanese.
Oh, interesting, man. Maybe that's the Snow Queen branding is still so powerful in Japan, maybe. I don't know.
I think it's more like in America, Disney was like, "Peep, the boys aren't going to see a movie with a girl's name in the title. Get that Anna crap out of there."
Yeah, that makes sense too.
Yeah. It's why, like, as soon as Mara's Needs Moms fail, they're like, no woman can be referenced in a movie title ever.
Ralph can wreck things. Anna can't be with a Snow Queen.
When people see Moana, they don't know what it means. We can let Moana through, but other than that. According to Josh Gad, the version he initially worked on was much closer to Anderson's original story and featured Megan Mullally as the voice of Elsa. And he also says this early version was going to be traditionally animated, but that seems pretty unlikely based on where Disney was at this point in time. So what I'm guessing is Josh Gad knows as much about animation as the common person. And when he's going in to do the voice, they're showing him drawings. The animatic is drawn. He's assuming, oh, this is going to be a drawn feature. I don't think Disney was greenlighting a 2D animated feature in the 2010s.
No, I would imagine they were just showing him, like, you know, traditional animatic from a storyboard, and he thought, like, oh, so this is what it's going to look like, not that that's where you start before you start making the CGI models that you then start animating. It sounds like a classic Gad gaff.
Mm-hmm. In my eyes, he can do no wrong. Josh Gad is new to me, and I'm enjoying him right now.
Oh, also, Megan Mullally, like, getting cut from another thing, just like with B-Movie.
Oh, yeah. It was B-Movie she was cut from?
Well, she was supposed to be the queen in that one, remember?
Right, and then,
yeah,
right.
She has a smaller role in it. She technically is in it, but yeah.
I'm sure that she's some voice in something, and I'm forgetting. They have to take advantage of that great voice in something, right?
Yeah, I'm sure she's been in like 8 Disney things, though. None are coming to mind here. She much like Josh Gad, she's honestly overcast and stuff. Hmm.
So the film is announced on December 22nd, 2011, and given a release date of November 27th, 2013. And the husband and wife duo of Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez joined the project as songwriters in early 2010. We'll talk more about them later.
Okay.
Actually, it's early 2012. I apologize. So early 2012, those two joined the party. So Buck is getting this version of the Snow Queen off the ground. An early meeting with John Lasseter changes the direction of the project. So after looking at some early storyboards, Lasseter enjoyed the lighthearted tone Buck was going for, but the characters were so shallow he feared that the audience couldn't relate to them. In an early version of the project, Anna, Elsa, and Kristoff were all in place, and the project really turned a corner when some unknown person, they don't remember who it was, they proposed, what if Anna and Elsa were sisters? That unlocked the entire project. Like, oh, that's a great connection. Lasseter was like, oh, at Disney, we've never done a movie about sisters. He never saw Lilo and Stitch, I don't think.
Yeah, that's entirely about sisters.
Yeah.
Like, but it's easy to, you know, do an autopsy on the story afterwards about like, oh, this is why it works, this is why it's good. But yeah, like to have it be a sister's story and ultimately a story about sisterly love and familial affection like that. That is just so sweet and nice, especially with Disney's history of evil stepsisters, sisters that don't, in other than Lilo and Stitch, if there ever are sisters, they're like cruel to Cinderella, as most people know them for.
So they unlock the sister idea that makes the movie seem possible. And at this point, they have a sisters summit at Disney where all of the female employees with siblings come in and talk about their experiences, help give the writers information to fuel the realistic connection between Anna and Elsa.
Yeah, no, and when you think about it from a business standpoint, hey, why have a movie with one princess when you can have two princesses?
Cha-ching! They didn't add a third princess in Frozen 2. I'm disappointed. So at this point, we're not very far from the film set in stone release date. There are Happy Meals waiting to fly off the shelves. We need to get the movie out. And this is when Wreck-It Ralph screenwriter Jennifer Lee is brought in to save the project. She'd eventually become the film's co-director.
Wow.
And with the release of Frozen only 17 months away, things had to be changed and fast. So there are some core concepts in place, but Frozen had to be re-engineered from the ground up. And some big changes were put into place, and I'll tell you a few of the major ones right now. So, in the original version, Elsa apparently kidnapped Anna from her own wedding and froze her heart, and her entire journey was about trying to reach Prince Hans and kiss him to cure her condition. They decided to subvert this with the great plot twist that Prince Hans is secretly evil, though they always intended for Anna to save Elsa, but they didn't know how they would get there.
Now, this subversion in the movie, it was also, like, so interesting at the time and still holds up really well, of just that it is Disney making fun of Disney. Now, we have already, like, when we cover the Renaissance films, like, Mulan was also meant to be a subversion, and I think is, to a degree. It's a feminist-style subversion of these things. Like, actually, the princess is also the great warrior who saves the day and proves that the chicks can do it, too. Like, but this is even more of a subversion of, like, it keeps setting you up for true love's kiss will save the day and you should marry the first man you've ever met in your life. Yeah. Like all of these things that were real plot points in old Disney movies.
Lindsay Ellis has been pointing this out, or she pointed it out in some video, and I've taken this to heart. Disney has been trying to make their movies like pop feminist since everybody reacted poorly to The Little Mermaid and the relationship and the feminism going on in there, the lack thereof. So this is not new. But I feel like there are some new ideas, like the idea of, yeah, there is no love at first sight. It's kind of crazy if you think about it.
You know, it's funny that Star Wars 7, The Force Awakened, did feel like a response to Red Letter Media and their prequel videos. And Frozen, to a degree, also feels similar to me in that it feels like a response to aughts YouTube essays about Disney movies, specifically, yes. I'd say, Lindsay Ellis's Nostalgia Chick stuff from the aughts.
Yeah, some of the movie does feel like customer service to me, in good and bad ways, I think. Also, apparently the song Let It Go really unlocked the character of Elsa for them and gave her the subtlety she was lacking in earlier versions of the film. Although, I love Let It Go. It's the best song in the movie. You don't need me to tell you it's a great song. I feel like it was written out of context. They're like, what's a proud anthem for a woman to sing? And they write it. But when Anna becomes who she truly wants to be, she devastates the entire kingdom. So it's not like, I'm going to be who I want and it's going to rule. It's like, no, you're hurting people. So I see people seeing Frozen as also a gay analogy. But if you look at it under that lens, it's like, no, the point was Elsa was too gay and it was causing a calamity. She needs to tone it down a little bit. If anything, the song should be called Tone It Down.
You're right. She sings Let It Go, and then she's like, yep, I'm a friggin' diva now. And then when her family shows up like, hey, you're kind of killing everybody, Elsa then just goes inside like, oh, how could I ever think I could let it go? Nothing ever will. Like, it is really sad, her reaction to it. But objectively, Let It Go, a lot of fun song. And I see why the gays like it so much. It is about, you know, it is a coming out party kind of song.
I really think it's a Rorschach test for whatever shit you're going through.
Sure.
A divorce, quitting a job, you know, problems with your siblings or a partner. I feel like it can really be applied to anything, which is why it's such a universally loved song.
Mm-hmm. Hey, just like, you know, I'm coming out. I want the world to know. That's technically not about being gay either, but you can see why.
Yeah, that's true.
Like that too.
But I will say the songwriters are straight, and I support my straight Broadway musical folks out there. There's not a lot of them.
It does seem like if you're not a gay person working in the media, then you have in Broadway, you have to be a wife guy usually. Devoted wife guy.
So there was also, in terms of things they changed, there was also an original mean version of Olaf that everybody hated. They just completely couldn't stand him. It was sort of like a snarky Iago-style sidekick, but they changed him into the naive, innocent comic figure that we all know and love. And honestly, I just saw Book of Mormon. He is Elder Cunningham, but with his libido removed. So they just, this is not a ripoff. It's a character type that I very much enjoy. But Elder Cunningham, the funniest breakout character from Book of Mormon, it's Josh Gad just doing that as a snowman, but without wanting to get laid.
Yeah, hey, when they hired Gilbert Gottfried to do Iago, it was, Gilbert Gottfried, do the thing you do, G-rated, and that's what they asked Gad to do.
And I do enjoy his work. We'll talk more about him later. So thanks to her work on the film, Jennifer Lee was promoted to co-director, which marks Frozen as the first time a woman ever directed a Disney animated feature. It took until 2013. But even though the fixed version of Frozen was seemingly locked down by November of 2012, a year before the film's release, by as late as February of 2013, the team realized things weren't working, and rewriting on Frozen was happening as late as June of 2013. June of 2013. The movie comes out in November. You have to render things. You have to bring in performers. Things have to be drawn. This is not usual. In fact, the song For the First Time in Forever was written in June of 2013, which shows how they were really working up until the last minute. That song is the backbone of Frozen, and it is written, 5 months before the movie is released? And I assume like 4 months before the movie has to be finished.
That is incredible. It works so well in the film that I would have figured it came in much earlier than that. And man, now I know why you hear about the production of the movies after this, Frozen 2. Also, there was a whole postmortem on Inside Out 2 about all of the crunch and crunch and crunch and fix it at the last minute. There is this feeling of, thanks to the success of Frozen and other ones, that, oh, this is just how it is. Like, you just crunch at the end and, hey, if it doesn't make sense 3 months out, don't worry. That's how it was with Frozen as well, and that we made it work.
Has any animated movie we've covered not been a complete disaster internally?
Boy, in the workup to it, it really is hard. Great Mouse Detective, that also was a problem. And I am really, it sounds like they just always are on fire, right?
Yeah, maybe like Batman Mask of the Phantasm was fine because it was just the TV crew doing a longer episode. But people in the comments, we've done like more than 70 of these. Remind us if there any animated movie has gone smoothly production-wise.
Oh, please. You know what? When Mask of the Phantasm had to be, when they decided it was theatrical, that actually was a real pain for them having to reformat it for widescreen.
Let's say a goofy movie and move on.
Yes, yeah.
I'm sure that was fine.
Yeah.
So yes, things are happening very, very late. And there are more production things I'll save for the movie discussion segment because we're about an hour in and there's a lot of extras on the Blu-ray. There's a lot of extras on Disney Plus. We can talk more about that stuff later. But now I want to talk about the talent behind Frozen. So one of the directors is Chris Buck. And I'm positive we covered him in great detail in our podcast about Tarzan, so check out that episode for a more thorough biography. But he's been working at Disney since 1978, so by the time Frozen releases, he's 35 years into his career at Disney.
Incredible. Yeah, when we got to him in Tarzan, he already was very well established at Tarzan.
And Jennifer Lee, the moral of the story with Jennifer Lee is it's never too late, so let me tell you about her. So outside of one short film in 2004... Jennifer Lee's first writing credit is on 2012's Wreck-It Ralph, so she lived an entire lifetime before joining Disney at age 40.
Wow.
This is chapter two of Jennifer Lee's life, working at Disney. So before Disney, she worked in the publishing world at Random House, both as a graphic artist and a designer of audiobooks. And then late in life, she entered Columbia University's film program and got her MFA in screenwriting in 2005. And after this, her yet-to-be-produced screenplay titled The Roundup got her a lot of buzz and was a quarter finalist in the Nickel Fellowships in Screenwriting Competition. We hear about these people who don't get any experience in television or film, but they write a screenplay for a competition that gets a lot of buzz, and that's how they get hired. I believe one of the writers of Toy Story 4 had that same experience. And I'm sure we talked about other people as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's been a lot of stories of, like, why does this, you know, if you show big promise as a screenwriter and you make, like, you know, one indie movie or what, like, that another of the writers of Wreck-It Ralph was the, and I interviewed him for it way back when, was the guy who did that Cedar Rapids movie that starred Ed Helms, which, and it was like, yeah, he made one successful indie film and they're like, hey, let's hire you. You work for Disney now and you're just going to fix all these things. Like, you, if they can count on you as a screenwriter, you can get a good job at Disney.
Oh yeah. Actually, that guy is Phil Johnston. And that is who hires Jennifer, because they were classmates at Columbia together and he recognized her talent and he brought her on to help write Wreck-It Ralph, and the rest is history. Her history with Disney begins here, but she's basically had a hand in nearly all of their animated features from Wreck-It Ralph onwards. And that's because after John Lasseter was kicked out of the studio, she became the chief creative officer of Walt Disney Animation Studios. And she only stepped down this year after 6 years of being in this role because she wanted to focus more on filmmaking, specifically working on the many, many, many Frozen sequels that have been greenlit so far. So talk about an amazing chapter two of your life. You have a career. Then you're 40, you start making movies at Disney, and then you become the CCO of the entire feature animation department. So way to go, Jennifer Lee.
Yeah, that is incredible. Yeah, I mean, like you said, let that be a lesson to people who think, like, oh, you know, I'm 40 or I'm 35. My Hollywood dreams are over. Like, not necessarily. Doesn't mean don't discourage yourself. And that she totally deserved that position from all her successes. And also, it helped as a way to be like, oh, we got rid of the sexist guy and we actually put in, like, one of the most successful women Disney has produced in, or who has worked for Disney this decade.
John Lasseter must be rolling in his grave.
And by that, you mean Netflix films nobody watches.
Yes, exactly.